Today you are with Janine Preston, and this podcast is sponsored by H2O Nero Clean Water Solutions. Today I'm introducing a man who inspired many by his adventure across the Atlantic. He has a maritime and adventure background, served as a naval combat officer in the South African Navy for 17 years, where he also qualified as a combat diver. During his time in the Navy, he completed 3 Atlantic crossings. He is also qualified 200T yacht captain, master of yachts, and has sailed extensively. He is an avid adventure racer, competing in many multi-day non-stop events that comprised of trail running, rock climbing, river rafting, and mountain biking. His many adventures include trekking the Himalayas, the stand-up paddle boarding through the Okavango Delta of the Botswana, and he arrived to Rio in a hero's welcome after a world record 7,200-kilometer solo transatlantic row from Cape Town to Rio. This man needs no introduction. His name is Zirk Botha. Hi, Zirk.
Hi, so nice to be able to join you.
And I really appreciate your taking the time to chat to us, because, I mean, you're such an inspiration and a worldwide hero at this time.
Thanks. Yeah, I really appreciate that. And it's very humbling to be in that position, because, you know, in South Africa and in the world, we're going through really, really challenging times. South Africa, we've had load shedding and water restrictions and COVID and state capture and all these things, you know, and I realized that halfway through the row that people were actually really desperate for something uplifting and inspirational. And I happened to be there at the right time, but it is very humbling to be in this position.
And you followed somebody's route. Tell me the story from the beginning, because we'd love to follow the journey from the idea to the finish.
It's quite a story, because I've been wanting to do something unique and big, because that's my approach for a while. And I had the seed that started growing. And then it germinates and you've got to put some fertilizer on it. And then about 2 years ago in February 2019, I got to the point where I just said to myself, are you going to keep on thinking about this, or are you going to do something? And at that stage, I'd become a little bit frustrated, because there were other people doing similar things. And then I realized, you know what, it's not their fault. It's your fault. You haven't taken action. And then right there and then I decided, okay, I'm going to do this. I still have an opportunity to make it unique by being the first solo rower to row from Cape Town to Rio. Then the planning started. Research and doing all my homework. It was quite a process to be ready for the departure end of last year.
And you followed somebody's route. Somebody had done one before and had taken 100 days to do a similar trip.
Yeah, so there's actually been 4 South Atlantic crossings. So the first one was a Brazilian guy called Amir Klink. He rode from Lüderitz to Salvador in Brazil. So it was a different route. It's an Atlantic crossing, but a different start place, a different finish place. And he took 144 days. And then there was also a Latvian guy, 2 of them, that also rode from Lüderitz to Salvador. And then 5 years ago, there was a pair that did the same route as what I did. Wayne Robertson and Bram Malherbe rode from Cape Town to Cabo Frio, which is in the state of Rio. They took 92 days. And then I came along and smashed all of that with 72 Jeez. Days. Continent was 69 days, and then the full route was 72 days, yeah.
And did you row or did you sail?
No, I rowed. No sails. It's all rowing. It's all personal power, you know. I was the captain, I was the navigator, I was the engine, everything.
But now tell me something. How did you know in which direction to row? And I know there's things like compasses and what have you. But it, to me, it just, it's mind-boggling that you were able to row, obviously, with your back to your destination, knowing that you were going in the right direction and you weren't going to end up in probably Atlanta in the U.S.
Yeah, so it is navigation. I had a navigational app that I used to check my position and to check if I was on the route that I had planned. But then, you know, as you say, facing the wrong direction, I just used my compass. So I would be watching my compass to make sure that I was going in the right direction. And then every 2 to 3 hours, I would check my position on my navigational app. And then daily, I would do a navigational update and plot it in my logbook to make sure.
And tell me something, when you slept, how did you know your boat wasn't going to turn around, or did you throw anchor? Because I mean, the anchor must have dropped quite a way down if you needed to drop one.
So there's no anchoring. What we do use in situations like that is what we refer to as a sea anchor. It's like a parachute. So it's a parachute in the water. But no, I did not. I only used my parachute anchor twice. But most of the times what I would do is from my shore team, they would look at the weather forecast and then I would know that for the period that I was resting, the wind and the weather was still, you know, what direction it was going. So, I just used the weather and the wind to my advantage. So that even while I was resting, I was still making headway in the right direction.
But if you had no sails, how was your boat being pushed along by the wind? And I'm sorry, I've never done the sailing thing. So.
No, that's a fair and a very good question. So in ocean rowing, there are two designs of boats. The one is called a traditional design, and then there's an open class design. My boat is an open class design. And it is designed to have the cabin in the front of the boat with a hatch opening to the back. So there is a little square area that's facing back. And in this case, that is where the wind effect came into play so that it still did. It's like, let's call it a miniature sail, a miniature rigid sail.
Wow.
But, you know, very, very small, but just enough to keep me going in the right direction.
And were you not afraid while you were sleeping a storm would rise, or had your team told you that something like that was on its way for you to be aware of it?
Yeah, no, I was pretty much aware of the weather that was coming. So they would, every morning, they would send me updates for the current day and the next 2 days. So I had a good idea of what weather was heading my way. Not that I would have been able to do anything about it. But I could prepare myself for it and tie everything down and yeah.
Did you have any rough weather on your way over?
I did. I had on New Year's Eve and the first and the second, I was off the west coast of South Africa, quite far north, when I had to go through a storm. The waves were 4.5 meters high, 35 knots of wind.
Wow!
It was quite a storm. It was my first big storm of the crossing, so it was quite an experience because you know I didn't know how the boat would fare in really really rough weather. But it all worked out fine. The boat was very very seaworthy. It's an excellent design. So we just got through it. Yeah.
But now in terms of your oars, are they secured to the boat or, how do they work to make sure that when you were sleeping, they weren't going to slip out of the where they were being held?
Yeah. So the oars normally when you row go through oar locks or we call it gates. But then I also have brackets on the boat. So the everything is tied down and secured. So even if the boat did roll over, nothing would go missing because it's all tied down. So when I wasn't rowing, the oars was lashed down, everything was lashed down.
So the boat was designed in such a way that even if you capsized, you as a solo person out there in the middle of nowhere was able to turn the boat back the correct way.
Yeah, so the boat is designed like a lifeboat. It would actually self-right. So I wouldn't even have to turn it back up. It would do that by itself because of the ballast and the buoyancy. And I was always in rough weather. I was tethered to the boat, so I was tied to the boat, so that should the boat roll over, I wouldn't get separated from the boat because that would have been fatal.
I was going to say that would have been a disaster. How did you get signal out there? I mean, I know the Vodacom towers stop on landlock, and they don't go out that far. Were you able to use a satellite link, or how does it work?
Yes. I had a satellite phone, and through the satellite phone, I had text and data and voice facility. And then I had a second satellite phone, which was just a text facility as a backup in case something happened with the first one. So that was my means of communication with my team ashore.
Now, your previous, the three or four previous people who did the same journey, as it were, did they have the technical backup that you had on this trip?
I can't speak for the first two, the non-South Africans, but I know that the previous South African pair, Wayne and Bram, that did the pairs crossing about 5 years ago, Wayne is a highly qualified yacht captain. So he does have a maritime background and experience. I think my experience as a naval combat officer, the time that I'd served in the Navy with lots of sea time and my ocean crossings was really critical, to pulling this off. I would advise strongly against anybody that doesn't have a maritime background to attempt this. It would be really problematic.
Were you at any time frightened, or did you feel insecure at any point in this crossing? Because there you were on the Atlantic, as they say in Afrikaans, stoksiel alleen, and really just a flight away from somewhere, from your nearest point. Were you at any time frightened, anxious?
No, I wasn't. And I think the reason for that was, again, because of my maritime background. So, you know, and also the boat design and the equipment on the boat. So I knew that the boat was pretty secure. It's got 11 watertight compartments. It's got a four-person life raft. It's got an emergency position indicating radio beacon that also communicates through the satellite network. So I knew that if there was an emergency, there's a massive search and rescue network, maritime search and rescue network internationally, and I would be fine. I knew I might be in discomfort for a few days if I ended up in the life raft, but I wasn't concerned about my life. So I never had that worry or that concern. I knew in the worst case scenario, it would still be okay.
And I think that's probably what gave you the courage, because you're a very courageous man. I must admit, when I do a yacht trip, it has to be not out of the harbor wall, because I'm a little bit afraid of those big waves. So I must admit, I completely admire you for having done this trip. Well, tell me a little bit about the food. You clearly had to take certain types of food or prepare for a certain length of time, because you couldn't cook on board. Or how did you manage with your food?
Yeah, so, and that was part of the research and the preparation. All my food was pre-prepared, pre-packaged. A lot of it was dehydrated, freeze-dried. And then what I did, I had different sponsors. So Genesis Nutritional Products was a big sponsor of mine. They have products that are normally used for disaster relief, SPAR. And then a South African supplier called Nom Nom. They make adventure foods. So it was all prepackaged. And then I had lots of sweets and chocolates and nuts and stuff like that as well. Unfortunately, not enough Omar rusks. I had more than enough coffee. Very, very important.
But how did you make your coffee? Did you use a battery, or how did you boil the water?
Yeah, so all my food that I had to warm up was done with a little hiker's gas cooker. So a little gas stove, and I had designed and I made a gimbal so that it would, roll and adjust for the movement of the boat in the sea while it was heating the water. So everything was basically a factor of warm water. So my main meal, which was the nom nom meals, I would put in the gas or in the water, my little tub, my little pot, and the gas would warm, heat the water, boil the water, and so the boiling water would heat my food, and then the coffee, it was the same. I would just boil my water, and because it had to be filter coffee, it had to be plunger coffee.
Oh my goodness! So,
yeah, and then I was, when we grew up, we always used to get the condensed milk, the little Durkies.
Correct, with the milk,
in that little triangular foil packet.
That's
and a
right.
friend of mine said, oh, you need to take Durkies for your coffee and everything. I said, do they still exist? We tracked them down, and they backed me by giving me a whole lot of Durkies that I use for my coffee and putting in my porridge to sweeten it up and add some energy to it. That was it. Everything was basically a function of adding water or some form of liquid to it. I had 6 meals a day. Of which a few was just sweets and chocolates. So I needed to have,
I think you certainly needed
energy.
Them.
Yes.
Looking at the size, you're a fairly sort of slim man. So I can only imagine that you needed every bit of energy that you could get from the food intake.
Yeah, I actually had lost a lot of weight during the row. I'm not normally this slim. I lost about 12 kilograms in muscle mass. Before I started the row, I was quite a bit more bulky than what I am now.
How many kilometers a day did you row?
I can tell you, I can do a quick calculation because everything's calculated in nautical miles. My average nautical miles was 58 nautical miles per day. So that would work out to about 105 kilometers, roughly, per day that I rowed.
And that's making good time because you were rowing with waves, so you weren't rowing on a flat surface. Or did you actually have a lot of flat surface time, or was it mostly waves?
No, I had a lot of waves and swells, but that was an added advantage because they also have energy, so they actually helped to push me ahead. And then there was a lot of times that I was semi-surfing those waves. So, it helped me to go faster. It was a big advantage. Nature really came to the party and was really a big part of me establishing the world record.
So that was that's another first, obviously, for a South African, because you're a South African. For South Africa, we have another world record.
Yeah.
And you beat it by 30 days, if I'm correct?
20 days. Yeah. I improved it by 20 days. Yeah.
And when you arrived on that side, was there an arrival party for you? Because I know you arrived to a hero's welcome, but does that mean there was a big party on the shore when you arrived? And I'm assuming you arrived in the harbor.
Yeah. So, wow, it was phenomenal. And, about 3 weeks before the end, the reality started settling in that, we've got COVID and it's lockdown and this quarantine requirement. So my team members that were supposed to go to Brazil to be there to receive me when I arrived could not leave South Africa. And that I thought, I'm going to do this major thing and there's not going to be anybody to receive me. But through a mutual friend, they had established a big network of people, different role players in Cabo Frio in Brazil. And they had started planning and rolling out. So even outside the harbor of Cabo Frio, the local canoe club, they do outrigger rowing. They came with about 10 outriggers. The NSRI was out there with boats and jet skis. The harbor police were out there. There were people out in their leisure craft, their ski boats, all just coming out to receive me and to welcome me. And then going into the harbor, you know, you go through a channel to go into the harbor, the port at Cabo Frio. And on the one side, there's like viewpoints and walkways. And there was people standing there shouting and cheering. And at the yacht club, it was the same. It was really, there was just like the turnout was phenomenal. It was unbelievable. I was completely blown away.
And I see the first thing that you wanted to eat was a burger and have a Coke.
Yeah, that was quite an interesting story because, you know, during the crossing, the people on the social media would say, oh, what are you craving? What you would like? What would you like to have when you get there? And, so, you know, at that stage, I had been eating the same food every day. And I was thinking, you know, I'm not a big burger fan. You know, I like it on occasion, but for me, it was the variety of the tastes and the textures. And the chips were salt. I was just craving salty stuff. So that's why I thought, okay, you know, a burger and chips would be great. And an ice cold Coke. So I was early. You know, the whole reception and the official welcome had been planned. We all worked out and predicted that I will be there on the 28th. And then I ended up in the last 3 weeks making such good time that I was a day and a half ahead of schedule. So then we said, okay, well, what now? And I said, no, I want to finish. I'm tired of this now. I said, no, no, you can't. We've set this whole thing up for you and the media and everybody's, you know, ready for the 28th. So there's a neighboring town to Cabo Frio, you know, and both these towns, this area is in the state of Rio de Janeiro. So they said, no, you've got to go to Búzios. And Búzios is it's got a lovely little bay that's completely sheltered. So I said, okay. So I went into Búzios. I arrived there at 10:30 at night. And as I'm going around the corner, so now I'm going backwards. So I've got the strobe light flashing so that everybody can see me and stay out of my way because I'm just looking on my navigational app to see where I'm going. And then as I get closer, I jump up and I look over the canopy to see where I am and where the
in case you're heading for a very large craft.
Yeah. And then as I come around the corner into the bay, I hear these guys calling my name. I think, am I losing my mind? You know, this is a town where nobody knows me, but there's somebody on the beach calling me. And the one photographer that had been contracted through the network and because my media manager, Sue, couldn't be there, he lived in Búzios. And he saw on the communications that they had established with the team that I was going to be there. And then he saw, I wanted to have a burger. So he actually waited for me to arrive. And then he was waiting on the beach for me with the burger and chips. so that was quite random. And then that, you know, because that was my official finish of the crossing, that was 69 days. But then the welcome was a few days later at Cabo Frio. So I stayed in Búzios for a little bit more than a day at anchor after I had my burger. And then I carried on to Cabo Frio for the official welcome and the reception. Yeah.
And tell me something. When you got off the boat for the first time, possibly to reach for your burger and Coke, you must have walked through the beach waves to get to the beach. Did you find yourself a bit sort of unbalanced or a bit wobbly because you'd been through the rocking motion of the sea?
I did. Because I'd been in the Navy and I spent a lot of time at sea, you know, when people say, oh, after sea, I'm feeling wobbly, whatever. I thought, nonsense, man. I've spent 17 years in the Navy and I never felt wobbly. But it's all about the size of the boat, you know, and how stable it is. And this time, because I mean, obviously it was quite a lot smaller than a Navy ship. It was very unstable and I wasn't, you know, balancing well when I got to the beach.
I can just imagine. Because I can only imagine what it must be like to be on this waving, rocking motion and then you suddenly get to a solid piece of ground. As you were crossing the ocean, did you come across any sea life, for instance, whales or sharks that might have, you saw the shark fin and thought, uh-oh, and the sound of jaws came through your head?
You know, I was surprised about the lack of sea life. And I've made quite a few statements about that. I'm really concerned that there's some fishing fleets from certain countries that are depleting our natural resources. And the evidence for me was the lack of sea life that I experienced. But I did have some really, really unique experiences. The first one was about a week after the big storm on the African coast. You know, that's where the reality set in. So that was about 2.5 weeks into the row, and now I'm starting to feel lonely. And so, and then I see a dolphin swimming towards a boat, and then I see, there's like 10, 12 of them. And this is my first contact with another living being. And I'm thinking, they're going to come and, you know, look at the boat. And then they just swim straight past and keep going. And I think, no, don't go.
Hang
around a bit. But then I did, 2 weeks later, there was another pod of dolphins that did hang around. And they did play around the boat for about 10 minutes, which was a really, really special experience. And then the other experience that I had that's more comparable to sharks was marlin. I had three marlin, single marlin on each case, so three different occasions. A little one and then a medium-sized one. And the biggest one was about 3.5 meters that swam past the boat and so close to the boat that if I reached out, I could have touched it. A marlin in its natural habitat at sea, I didn't know that. But when I saw it, it's the most beautiful creature. It's like a shimmering turquoise color. It's phenomenal. It was really, you know, having that experience was just, I was blown away. So that was a real special experience. And then I saw the odd dorados and a sunfish and a turtle, but few and far in between. It was really, really disappointing.
That's very sad.
Yeah, very sad. Very much, yeah.
And in terms of like sunset and sunrises, you were rowing obviously across time zones. How did you keep yourself balanced with what time of the day it was, or did it matter?
For the first half of the row, I stuck to South African time because then I could relate to what my family was doing. My kids, you know, knowing they're getting up, they're going to school, they're going to work, you know, whatever they were doing. But then it became completely out of whack. And then I started changing to the time zones of where I was. And then at the end, so Brazil and South Africa are 5 time zones apart. Towards the end, yeah, it became quite a difference. And, it took a while for my biological clock to get used to the new time zones.
Did you talk to your children often?
Pardon?
Did you talk to your children often?
I did. The satellite phone had a voice facility. So my daughter had a birthday. Obviously, I phoned her on her birthday and we chatted and on Christmas. And no, I didn't phone on New Year's. So, yeah, I chatted quite often. But I texted them, lots. It was just easier, you know, the voice communications wasn't always clear and was disrupted, so it was a bit frustrating. But the text messages and emailing was really good. So, and it was also a way for me to reassure them or assure them, whichever way you look at it, that I was okay. You know, I was safe. Everything was still okay with me, which was important. For them to know, and it was important for me to know that they're okay, then they're not worried about my well-being.
And how old are they?
So my son is, I'm going to have to calculate, he's 34. and then my daughter is 32 and a half. And then the younger ones are 15 and 10. So I've got quite a spread.
My goodness me. And I'm sure they're just so proud of you. And they must have been relieved when you finally arrived.
Yeah,
and did you not feel that you needed to row back, or were you quite happy to fly back? Oh, there we go. So tell me a little bit about your family. You have children?
Yeah, I hope you can hear me. So my son is 34, and then my older daughter is 32 and a half. And then the two little girls, well, not so little, but they're 15 and 10. Yeah, so quite a spread of ages in the kids.
So that's quite a big age gap. And I bet they were so happy to hear that. They were so happy to hear that you'd landed in Rio, because I bet they were the first ones you told when you got there.
Yes, I did. I phoned them just before I arrived, before the official welcome and the media boat arrived. I gave them a call and had a quick chat and said to them, "Ah, it's finished. It's over." Yeah.
And I have just a laugh. I have a last question for you. Did you not feel before you flew back that you wanted to row back?
I'm never rowing an ocean again. There was no question about that. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I got the T-shirt. I don't need another T-shirt with the same branding on it. Yeah.
I really appreciate you having joined us on this, on the journey that we've taken with you. I felt like I was with you in the boat, rowing across the sea, and for sharing your thoughts, and obviously to your team and your sponsors. I think they were great. Maybe you wanted to take a moment to thank all of them on air.
Yeah, please, that's great. You know, a project like this isn't possible without backing of corporates, because it requires a big investment, and as an individual, we don't always have the resources readily available. So having a company like UE Renewable Energies, that was my biggest backer for this project, was great. But then also the other companies like Nova Marine that supplied all my safety equipment. They also provided the satellite data connection. And then going through, as I mentioned earlier, Genesis Nutritional Products, Aerontech, Bulwark, Sartex, the Durkee guys, Spar, Fleetmon that provided my satellite trackers, Storm Geo that provided the software for the weather systems. It's amazing. You know, they all came on board. They trusted me when I gave them my proposals that I would deliver on what was promised. And it's great, you know, that there are corporates like that in South Africa that are prepared to take the risk, because, you know, that taking the risk and taking on a big challenge is also part of my motivation. You know, as we chatted earlier and we said that South Africa and globally, we're going through difficult times. And I'm hoping that through me doing this row, I would inspire and motivate people that they would say, well, if this 59-year-old guy from Cape Town can row from Cape Town to Rio, then I can do anything, you know, and to inspire people to take on their big projects and their big challenges, and make a difference to themselves and make a difference to their families and the world. Oh, yes.
And
you know,
would you like to mention
they
your support team?
All volunteered. They didn't get paid for this. Some of them were co-opted. They didn't even volunteer. but having, my old school friend Hugo, Lopesher, he lives in the Garden Route, and when he saw I was doing this, he made contact with me and he said to me, "Sir, who's supporting you? Who's your support team?" And I said, "No, well, I don't have anybody." He said, "No, that's unacceptable. I'm your support team." And then after that, I got another old Navy friend of mine on board. And then my friends where I'm staying now, as I'm settling back in, Geordie and Allison. Allison became my weather guru. She had no background in weather, but she just made it her priority to get to know the software that was supplied by Storm Geo, and she became a real weather guru through the experience and learning. And then Wayne Robertson, who was rowed previously as a pair with Brahm, he was also part of my team, so he was also available to give me advice based on his experience. Phenomenal, amazing that they all just gave up. And it was a 24/7. Sometimes Alison would, in the middle of the night, she would message me to check in how I was doing, give me the latest weather update. It's vital to have a support team that are there for you 24/7. Amazing. I love them and I appreciate what they've done for me.
I must absolutely. Say, they've done a phenomenal job.
Absolutely. You know, and then the other person that was also part of the support team is Sue from Catalyst Media, my media manager. Because a project like this is aimed at generating exposure for a cause to create that awareness. And she's done a phenomenal job to make sure that the message has gone out internationally on sustainable development and the motivational, inspirational side of the project. Amazing. It's been such a rewarding, it was challenging, but it's been such a rewarding project. It's been life changing for me.
And what would, in closing, what would your message
do
be
it.
To
Go
anyone
for
out
it.
There considering
Dream
doing
big,
something like this?
Do big, live a great adventure.
Thank you. And I really appreciate your time. Thank you, Zirk. Zirk Buerta, adventurer, combat diver, and his best achievement to date has definitely been rowing solo from Cape Town to Rio. Most people do it in a yacht. Thank you for joining me, Janine Preston, with another podcast sponsored by H2O Naro, Clean Water Solutions.